Hi, my name is Matt Smith, and I'm one of the co-pastors here at the table at Central United Methodist Church. You're listening to the podcast from our Candlelight Christmas Eve gathering. This podcast weaves together the message shared this evening in worship, along with selections of the music that we experienced here together as we gathered to celebrate the beauty and the mystery of Christmas Eve. We will be together tomorrow morning for Christmas Day for one service only at 9:30 in the morning here in the sanctuary at 5265 H Street, and we would love for you to join us there. And then we'll turn our entire campus into a home for around 100 unhoused guests to be with us during this week, and we would love for you to take time now to sign up online at thetableumc.org to reach in love by joining us in extending hospitality to the unhoused adults who will make this sanctuary their home for the week ahead. We also will gather on New Year's Day for just one worship service at 9:30, so please make note of that. As we do move toward the end of the year, we wanted to share just a brief update on the finances for our church community. We began the month of December looking as though we would finish the year about $10,000 down. We had phenomenally generous first three Sundays here in December, and so it looks like it is actually possible that we could finish the year in the positive, but we know we will rely upon the phenomenal generosity of folks in our community to help us do just that over these final days of 2016. So we know that not everyone is in a place where we can extend beyond where we already have, but some of us, we trust, might be led by God to share from a place of generosity so that this community can close the gap and that we can cover all of our ministry expenses this year. So if you're one of those people who might be in a place where you can extend, whether that is going beyond your original deep commitment or making a first-time gift today, we would invite you to do so online at our website, thetableumc.org. Merry Christmas, and thank you for listening.
There is a light, bright star shining in the dark night. Old tales come true. All of our fears, hopes and prayers, God has heard and answered us. The light came down, cast the darkness away. God appeared, a helpless child. The light of God came down.
In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, and without him, not one thing came into being. What has come into being in him was life, and the life was the light of all the people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify to the light so that all might believe through him. He himself was not the light, but he came to testify to the light. The true light, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world came into being through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to what was his own, and his own people did not accept him. But to all who received him, who believed in his name, he gave power to become children of God, who were born not of blood or of the will of the flesh or of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and lived among us. And we have seen his glory, the glory as of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth.
There is a light, new day dawn. things pass, all things made new.
I'm going to open with a story. And some of you may have heard about this. It happened back in 2007, January. And there was a violinist who emerged from the metro at the L'Enfant Plaza station, and he positioned himself against a wall right next to a trash basket. There was really nothing outstanding about his appearance. He was youngish, jeans, long-sleeved t-shirt, baseball cap. And with his violin case open in front of him and a few dollars that he threw in himself, you know, just to prime the pump, he picked up his instrument and he began to play to the passersby at the metro. And it was 7:51 a.m. on a Friday, January 12th, in the middle of the morning rush hour. It was really packed. There was a steady stream of people, and in the next 43 minutes, as the violinist performed six classical pieces, the count was that 1,097 people passed him by. Almost all of them were on their way to work, which meant for almost all of them a government job, because this was in Washington, D.C. Each one of those 1,097 passersby had a quick choice to make. Maybe you've had that same choice in Midtown, or if you're like me, you BART into the Bay Area. You come up out of BART and there's street performers. Right? Do you stop and listen? Do you move on past? Do you throw in some money just to, like, be polite because they're working hard? Does it change if the musician really is bad? The performer is really good. Do you pay enough attention, though, to even notice? On that Friday in January, those private questions were going to be answered in a very public way, because no one knew it but that performer, the violinist, standing outside a bare wall at the metro by the escalators, was one of the finest classical musicians in all of the whole world. His name is Joshua Bell, and he was playing some of the most elegant music that's ever been written on one of the most valuable violins that exists. His performance was actually arranged by the Washington Post. It was an experiment in context, perception, and priorities, as well as an unblinking of public taste. In an ordinary, nowhere special-like setting, subway station, at a very inconvenient time, would beauty transcend? Would people notice music? And as it turns out, not so much. Let's watch.
Thank you.
Just 3 days before what you just saw, Joshua Bell had filled the house at Boston Stapley Symphony Hall, where like just pretty good seats go for $100 a piece. 2 weeks after this performance at the Music Center at Strathmore in North Bethesda, I can't say it. Help me, Brendan. He would play to a standing room only audience. So respectful of his artistry, reporters said that they stifled their coughs until the silent time between his movements, and then everyone starts coughing. But on this day, Friday in January, he was just another panhandler, competing for the attention of really busy people on their way to work. Really, almost no one gave him the time of day. Does that sound familiar at all? The true light, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world, yet the world did not know him. Somehow, so long ago, I think the writer of the Gospel of John was an observer of human behavior and had come to an understanding of what we just saw illustrated. We seem to miss a lot of things that are going on right in front of us or right next to us. Really important things. Transformational, even. But the writer of the Gospel of John noticed. He seems to be one, I think, who might have stopped at the subway. Probably thrown in a few dollars. He lifts up another John in verse 6. There was a man sent from God whose name was John, and he came as a witness to testify to the light so that all might believe through him. He himself was not the light, but he came to testify to the light. That John noticed too. See, the opening prologue in John's gospel may just be his attempt to remind us, to inspire us, to lure us from our rapid pace of living to slowing down and noticing. As in contrast to the detailed narrative story scenes in the Gospels of Matthew and Luke, you know, with the images and the descriptions of Mary and Joseph and the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, there's those wise ones, the evil Herod. The Gospel of John that we heard tonight is different. And it gives us this puzzling opener. How could the light that illumines everyone, all of humanity, come into the world and not be recognized? How does that happen? Like we saw at the subway station. Not noticing is easier than we may realize. Like, have you ever decided to stop for a cup of hot cider with your kids on the way home from school one day? Only to find yourself turning in on your street and your daughter says, Mom, weren't we going to the coffee house? I'm like, yeah. Jeez. When did I go on to automatic pilot? I'm in the car with my most beloveds and I miss the whole experience because my brain is thinking of other things. The poet W.H. Davies writes, "What is this life if full of care? We have no time to stand and stare." Or maybe we do stand and stare, but we just don't notice the light because we don't expect it to appear quite in the way that it does. See, I believe we want to see the light, but more often than not, we end up sitting in darkness. A friend of mine reminded me this week that darkness actually isn't a thing. Okay? Darkness is not a thing. It doesn't have power or substance. Darkness is not evil or inherently bad in any way, but our fear of it is a big thing. That's different. Our fear carries solid weight in our bodies and in our hearts. Wearing darkness's mask, our fear drives us away from the light and can really drive us into ways that are evil. And this can be really obvious But sometimes it's really mundane, ordinary. It looks like walking past the music. And I believe it's because we have a tendency to miss this light when it appears in an unexpected way or an unexpected place. A world-famous violinist belongs on a world-famous stage, not a subway. And therefore, we miss the show. So maybe it is that our fear of the darkness is so strong that we just can't imagine anything else. So we don't. What might happen, though? Just what might happen if we try to imagine new frames for God's incarnation, like the one we heard Matt read in the Gospel of John? See, that gospel opens with, "In the beginning." He didn't just come to those words out of nowhere. "In the beginning" means he's framing his story in Genesis 1. Which reads, "In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the deep, while a wind from God swept over the face of the waters. And God said, 'Let there be light.' And there was light." God created speaking words. And John connects that beginning in Genesis with the Word in his gospel. We don't have a manger scene. No shepherds in the fields keeping watch by night. Instead, it reads, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." See, John's story connects us to the Genesis, the very beginning of all things. And John continues, "And the Word became flesh and lived among us, full of grace and truth." John's saying that God has been with us all along. And now God is going to come in a new way. Eugene Peterson, a scholar, paraphrases it this way: "The Word became flesh and blood and moved into the neighborhood." The Greek translation is actually "pitched a tent." So moving into the neighborhood feels pretty close, don't you think? Think about that for a minute. Picture where you live. Most of us at least know when people move in. God's not removed or remote. God is here. God is in the world. The Word that created is now part of the world created. He was in the world, and the world came into being through him. Yet the world didn't know him. He came as his own, and his own people didn't even accept him. If God moves into the neighborhood and pitches a tent, how can the world miss it? How can the world not notice that? How could the very light that enlightens everyone, all of us, come into the world and not be recognized? Shouldn't someone have noticed or recognized the birth of God, for goodness sake, for God's sake? I want to say Jesus Christ, right? In the 45 minutes that Joshua Bell played, 7 people stopped. It was a huge experiment. It's so interesting to read about. You should all do it. They stopped what they were doing, those 7 people, to hang around and take in the performance, at least for 1 minute. 27 people gave money, most of them on the run, for a total of $32. One woman gave $20. And there was a little bit of change. 1,070 people hurried by, most of them no more than 3 feet away. In an interview following the experiment, Joshua Bell said, "It was a strange feeling that people were actually, the world, it says, doesn't come easy to him, ignoring me." And he laughed at himself. "At a music hall, I get upset if someone coughs or if someone's cell phone. But here, my expectations quickly diminished. I started to appreciate any acknowledgement, even a slight glance. I was oddly grateful when someone threw in a dollar instead of change." I thought that was great. "This is from a man whose talents can command $1,000 a minute." And I want folks to know that the Washington Post had this whole strategy, because in their mind, they had a whole crowd control strategy. And what were they going to do with the money that he made? Before he began, Bill had not known what to expect, he said. What he does know is that for some reason, he said he was really nervous. He said, it wasn't exactly stage fright, but there were butterflies. I was stressing a little. Bell has played literally before the crowned heads of Europe. Why the anxiety at the Washington Metro Station, they asked him. Well, he said, when I play for ticket holders, I am already validated. I have no sense that I need to be accepted. I'm already accepted. Here, I had this thought, what if they don't like me? What if they resent even my presence? He was, in short, art without a frame. Art in the wrong frame is really easy to miss. We drive on autopilot. We walk on by it. There's a man, Mark Liedhauser. He's the senior curator at the National Gallery who has held many of works of art, like stunning works of art, in his own bare hands. And he's the one that oversees actually the framing of art paintings in the National Gallery. And Liedhauser said he thinks he has an idea of what happened at the metro station. So let's look at this. This is a painting by Ellsworth Kelly. Some of you may know of him. He's a minimalist painter, sculptor. For scale, that's like huge. Big. Let's say I took one of our more abstract masterpieces, an Ellsworth Kelly, and I removed it from its frame, and I marched it down the 52 steps that people walk up to get to the National Gallery, past the giant columns, and brought it into a restaurant. It's a $5 million painting. $5 million. And it's one of those restaurants where there are pieces of original art for sale by some industrious kids from a local school. And I hang that Kelly on the wall with a price tag of $150. No one is going to notice it, he said. An art curator might look at it and say, hey, that looks a little like an Ellsworth Kelly. Please pass the salt. His point is that context matters. Art without a proper frame is really easy to miss. Could it be that the gospel writer of John is on to the tendency of most of us to miss the light, just like people miss the world-famous violinist and might miss a $5 million masterpiece? Maybe we don't know how to frame the light. I want to share a haiku by the famous poet Basho. It's pretty well known, I think. An old silent pond. Into the pond a frog jumps. Splash. Silence again. The poet makes no comment about what he is describing. He simply invites our attention to no more and no less than just this. The old pond, in its watery stillness, a kerplunk of a frog, and the gradual return of stillness. In effect, the poet is putting a frame around the moment. And what the frame does is to enable us to see not just something about the moment, but the moment itself in all its ineffable, like, ordinariness and particularity. The chances are that if we had been passing by when a frog jumped, we wouldn't have noticed the thing. Or in noticing it, we wouldn't have given it a second thought. But this frame of this haiku sets it away and off from everything that distracts us. See, that's the nature and purpose of frames. Here is another way. A woman in our community said she needed a place to be able to be quiet, to think and to breathe, and she created this frame for herself in her bedroom. Framing may not change the moment, but it changes our way of perceiving the moment, right? It makes us notice a moment. We framed the season of Advent with an alley and that Gregory Porter song that we just heard, in the hope that God's frame of becoming human might be understood as God taking up residence in our neighborhood and in every neighborhood. If we were to rewind that video and play it back from the very beginning, there's this one guy there. He has khakis and a leather jacket, and he carries a briefcase. He was in his early 30s. His name is John David Mortensen, and he is, when he comes there, on the final leg of his daily bus trip from the bus to the metro in his commute in. He's heading up an escalator, and the escalator into where we saw this film is a really long ride. You're on an escalator for a minute and 15 seconds. They timed it. And that's if you just stand there and don't walk. So like most everyone who passed by Joshua Bell that day, Mortensen got a really good earful of music while he was on that escalator before he had any even visual of the musician. And like most of the people, he noted that it sounded pretty good. They interviewed everybody. But like a very few of them, when Mortensen got to the top, he didn't race past, as though Bell were some nuisance to be avoided. Mortensen is the very first person we see in the video to stop. That he has nothing else to do, he said. He's a project manager for an international program at the Department of Energy. And on this day, he has to participate right after this in a monthly budget exercise. Not the most exciting part of his job, he said. You review the past month's expenditures, forecasting spending for the next month. If you have X dollars, where is it going to go? That sort of thing. I was on my way there. And on the video, you can see him get off the escalator and look around. And he locates the violinist, and he stops, and he walks away, but then he walks back. And he checks the time on his cell phone, and he realizes, 3 minutes. 3 minutes, because he's that early for work. So for 3 minutes, he settles against the wall to listen. He said he didn't know classical music at all. He's a classic rock guy, as he likes it, but there was something, he said, about what he was hearing that he really liked. He goes, I didn't know about major or minor keys. Whatever it was, he said, though, it made me feel at peace. So for the very first time in his life, Mortensen lingered to listen to a street musician. He says his allotted 3 minutes was all he had. And as he stayed there for 3 minutes, 94 other people passed by. And when it was time for him to leave to go help plan those contingency budgets for our Department of Energy, for the first time in his life, he said, not quite knowing what had just happened, but sensing it was special, for the very first time in his life, he went and gave a street musician money. See, he didn't allow the darkness to limit him. He shifted his frame, and he noticed what was going on around him. And from that shift, the ordinary, mundane way of his day and job and routine and potentially the fear that he holds about what he's about to go in and do and fight for with those budgets, that's his usual frame. But on this day, in an ordinary, nowhere special setting, at an inconvenient time, beauty transcended, he noticed the music. Then he was moved to a sense of peace. And from that sense of peace, he was moved to an act of generosity. 3 minutes. There is a light new day dawning. Old things pass and all things are made new. Prophets have spoken all God would accomplish when the light of God would dwell with us. The light came down and cast the darkness away, and God appeared a helpless child. And the light of God came to save us, to the world that God made for us. O Lord, and O our Savior. Alleluia.
There is a light. Prophets have spoken all he would accomplish when the light of God would dwell with us. The light came down, cast the darkness away. God appeared a helpless child. The light of God came to save us, to